How's everyone? Thanks for coming out. I think this is my first public talk in Buffalo in, I think, a long time. I would say proud graduate of Bennett High School, but I wasn't very proud of Bennett High School. So I'm pretty happy to be here and thank everybody for coming. My name is Kianga Yamada Taylor. I'm an assistant professor of African American Studies at Princeton University, author of From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, How We Get Free, Black Feminism and the Combahee River Collective. And I have a book coming out in October with University of North Carolina Press titled Race for Profit, How Banks in the Real Estate Industry Undermine Black Home Ownership. And it's about the transition from federal redlining in the 1960s and 1970s to what I refer to as predatory inclusion into the U.S. housing market, and how ending redlining just opened up African Americans to more predatory real estate practices without actually solving a perennial housing crisis. So that will be out in October. So tonight I'm going to talk some about the Black Lives Matter book and How We Get Free. So I'm going to try to answer three questions about why I wrote the Black Lives Matter book and how that intersects with the How We Get Free book and the Combahee River Collective. There were a couple of things that I was trying to understand in terms of why the Black Lives Matter movement erupted when it did. And so there was obviously a prehistory, and the beginnings of movements are often contested. These are not facts set in stone. You know, with the civil rights movement, people ask or argue that it began with Emmett Till's funeral in terms of the kind of anger and bitterness that unleashed when his mother decided to have a public funeral and an open casket at the funeral, and what that communicated to Black people both in the North and the South. The funeral was in Chicago. He was lynched in Mississippi. Was that the beginning? Or was it the beginning of the sit-in movement in 1960 when Black students went to public establishments that they weren't served in? So there's a prehistory to Black Lives Matter that I write about in the book. Is the prehistory the murder of Oscar Grant, which is one of the first police murders to be captured by cell phone video on New Year's Day in 2009. I mean, I write about the murder of Oscar Grant by an Oakland Metro Transit cop in the context of he was killed in this particular manner before Obama was even inaugurated as president. He would go on to be inaugurated a few weeks later. And it telegraphed a certain continuity with the past into the Obama administration that many people thought the Obama administration was closing a chapter on. And it pointed to the continuity of these practices. So there's that. There's also the case of Troy Davis. Troy Davis was a Black man on death row in the state of Georgia. His innocence became the object of an international movement. People all over the world, including dignitaries, the former head of the FBI, William Sessions, the Vatican, there were a whole range of people who believed that Troy Davis was innocent and fought for a clemency hearing, fought for his execution to not happen. And the night that he was supposed to be executed, there were marches throughout Washington, D.C. of Black students demanding that Barack Obama, this was in September 2011, demanding that Barack Obama actually come out, address this issue, and do something. This was the reason why young African Americans had voted for Barack Obama in numbers that they had never voted for anyone before, was precisely for this moment, not to hear a bureaucratic definition of jurisdictional capacity or reach, which ultimately was Obama's argument that he, as president, did not have jurisdiction over this state-based execution. But Black people voted for him to intervene in that particular moment, or to at least say something. And he didn't say anything. Troy Davis was executed. And the next day, Obama sent his white spokesperson, Jay Carney, out to a press conference and simply said that this was a states' rights issue and Obama would have nothing else to say about the matter. So that was a catalyzing issue. Obviously, there was the murder of Trayvon Martin in the winter of February of 2012. That was a catalyzing event where for 45 days, George Zimmerman, who murdered Trayvon Martin, so Trayvon Martin is killed in a movement, a small, localized movement begins to try to get George Zimmerman arrested for this murder. Of course, Zimmerman is eventually arrested, goes on trial, July 2013, is acquitted. And through the course of the trial, it becomes apparent that Trayvon Martin is actually the one on trial for being a young, you know, black teenager, listened to rap music, who smoked weed, and obviously deserved to be killed. This was the undercurrent of the trial. This was the undercurrent of the mainstream media discussion about this issue. And so these were all contributing factors that contributed to what exploded into the Ferguson uprising in the summer of 2014. And so throughout all of this, part of what is significant in terms of the question that I was trying to answer is why was this happening? Because police brutality is not new. I write in my book that when these politicians come out and talk about, oh, we have to repair relations between the police and the black community, we have to get those things back together again, it assumes that they've ever been intact. And in fact, there is not a period in the history of the entire United States that the police have not been a force of brutality, repression, racism, and terrorism in black communities, particularly over the course of the 20th century. So this is not new. In 1951, black activists presented the United Nations with black activists who organized themselves as a collective called We Charge Genocide, or that was the name of their petition, We Charge Genocide, documenting hundreds of cases of police murder of black citizens throughout the United States. And they said, essentially, that once lynching had been the form of extra-legal terror used against black communities, today it's the policeman's bullet. So that was in 1951. So the issue of police brutality is not enough to look at as to why something like this happened. Instead, I look at the particular role of Barack Obama, and not necessarily the role in terms of what he may or may not have done, although some of the things that he didn't do certainly contributed to an atmosphere where African Americans, especially young people, perhaps felt that they had no other choice except to either go into open rebellion or to organize themselves. But the expectations that came with Obama's election were that things would be different. And I think the context is important, particularly coming out of 8 years of what can only be described as a disastrous Bush administration, George W. Bush, where the three central pillars of that disaster were Bush's illegal war in Iraq and Afghanistan as one pillar, the inept ways that the Bush administration responded to Hurricane Katrina, and literally allowed New Orleans to drown because it was mostly black people who were victims there. And then third, the collapse of the U.S. economy in 2008, which had disproportionately disastrous impacts in African-American communities. By the time the housing crisis that was the root cause of the 2008 economic crisis resolved itself, 244,000 black people lost their homes as a result. By August of 2015, black unemployment was at 17%. And this was connected to the aftermath, the ever radiating aftermath of the economic crisis during that period. And so people wanted to see something different. Black people in particular wanted to see something different. And so black women and young black people in particular voted for Obama at unprecedented rates for the first time in both 2008 and then again in 2012. The proportion of black voters outpaced the proportion of white voters, something that had never happened before in the history of the United States, at least when black people could vote. So with that kind of turnout came very big expectations as to what would be different. And so people always say, oh, you know, everyone was projecting onto Obama. Everyone had these unrealistic expectations. And to some extent, of course, that could be true. I mean, that happens in every election. But it also ignores the extent to which these expectations were stoked by the Obama administration, from the campaign slogans of hope and change, and change doesn't come from Washington, it comes to Washington, all of it, and the way that he himself framed his candidacy as the fruition of the civil rights movement, if not the continuation of the civil rights movement. Jay-Z said that Rosa sat so Martin could march, so Obama could become president, so all black people could fly, essentially. You know, and Obama didn't turn away these kinds of allusions and connections between his campaign and the civil rights movement. And I think aside from that, I'm probably as cynical as anyone when it comes to elected officials, particularly Democrats, who constantly just lie. I mean, they lie like cheap carpet. And telling us all the things that they think that we want to hear in a campaign and then doing absolutely nothing or doing worse than nothing in terms of stabbing people in the back. But Obama, when he was in the primaries running against Hillary Clinton, I mean, he said things that, you know, people have just not heard out of the mouth of a Democratic Party candidate. He invoked the abolitionist movement, talked about the sit-down strikes in the 1930s that were redolent of the trade union movement, talked about the Stonewall Rebellion in 1969. And so he talked about all of these moments of political insurgency and, again, connected his campaign to them in such a way that people had the expectation, you know, that, no, he wasn't going to be a radical president, but that he would perhaps fulfill his promises, or some of them, or speak to some of them. And instead, as soon as he becomes president, the narrative very quickly changes to all the things that he can't do and all of the unrealistic expectations we're all hoisting upon him, and that he is not the president of Black America. He is the president of all Americans. And so he's saying this and doing the backsliding at the same time that young African Americans' expectations are quite high. And there's also a growing cynicism developing around this issue of police brutality and police murder. An organization called the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement begins to chart the frequency with which black people are being killed by agents of the state. So police, security guards, some people who are killing black people in the name of some kind of official authority. And so they calculate that every 28 hours, a black person is murdered by an agent of the state. Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, comes out that begins to craft a narrative of what has happened in African-American communities over the last two generations and gives a narrative and language to this phenomenon of mass incarceration that the vast majority of black families and people have experienced, someone in prison, someone harassed by the cops, some form or another. And so those things are happening. At the same time, then you get the beginning of the video recorded police killings or incidents of police brutality. And so there is the demand that is beginning to develop that, well, we just voted for a black president and we expect the black president to do something about it. And it's not just the black president. There are more elected, black elected officials in the United States at this time than any other point in American history, aside from now. And so there is the expectation that, you know, with this much political access to power, that something should happen, that it can't just be the same thing that it has always been, even when African Americans were locked out of these positions of power. So that is one aspect of it. And I think that with Ferguson, what you get are you get more kind of outrageous cases and more brazen actions by the police that is sort of capped off by what happens in Ferguson, where the police murder this teenager and then literally leave his body in the street for 4 hours. I mean, this is what dictators do, right? This is what dictators do to send a message to the rest of the population as a means of control, manipulation, and to terrorize people. And this is happening in the streets of the United States with a black president. And so I think what you have is the rising expectations with Obama, and then you have brazen police brutality and a cynicism that governing institutions of this country are interested or, you know, are willing or even interested in doing anything about it, because it doesn't really appear to be the case. So you get the murder of Trayvon Martin, where there's no effort to locate his parents or anything on the night that he's killed. So you have that. You get Eric Garner, who was killed before Mike Brown Jr. in Staten Island, the black man who was choked on video, choked, says, "I can't breathe," 11 times, choked to death. And the cop who does it, is never arrested. He's still at home. He's still drawing a paycheck from the New York City Police Department. Tamir Rice, 12-year-old, who is shot, I think, 0.2 seconds upon the arrival of the police in Ohio, where it's an open carry state, where, you know, everybody is encouraged to have a gun unless they're black. And so you get these brazen cases of police abuse and violence and what seems like a complete paralysis of the federal government, the governing institutions of the country, to actually do anything about it. And it leaves people very little choice except to protest. And in Ferguson, the protests take a very particular form. It's an uprising. And I think that in both Ferguson and then Baltimore 9 months later, you have uprisings in places where people have absolutely no doubt that the police, the governing bodies, the mayor, have no interest in stopping this pattern of abuse. And so you literally have no choice but to erupt into rebellion to both draw attention to this situation, but to also get these people to stop what it is that they're doing. And so when people ask, what has Black Lives Matter accomplished? You know, and so depending on where you chart where things began or that sort of thing, if you're looking at Ferguson and then the kind of molding together of a national movement, which I look at Ferguson and then in the late fall of 2014, when the failure of grand juries in Ferguson and then in Staten Island refused to indict the cop who killed Mike Brown and then the cop who choked Eric Garner to death on video, that spilled over. It went from being a movement centered in Ferguson, of which there was solidarity actions around the country in support of, into a national movement that is cohered by the chants, slogans, "Hands up, don't shoot," "I can't breathe," and then "Black Lives Matter." And so in December of 2014, I think successive weeks, there were 50,000 people who marched through the streets of New York City. The following weekend, there were 100,000 people who marched on Washington, D.C. And so you went from localized cases around police brutality into a kind of national movement and national profile around these. And so what do they do? What do they help expose that I think is still significant in terms of Black Lives Matter's contribution to our understanding, a wider understanding? Because like I said, black people have always known that the police are racist, abusive, and have a extremely antagonistic relationship to black communities. But it exposed the extent to which police brutality and police murder cannot be defined as acts of, you know, bad apples or individual things. But, you know, for some people, they still think that. But for much larger numbers of people, that there are too many cases. There are too many crazy situations with the police to just reduce this to a single bad apple here or there. And so it began to show the systemic issues of abusive policing in the United States and helped to raise the question of what is the function of the police in this country. And I think in many cities, it helped to show that the police have become the public policy of last resort, which is to say that if you refuse to fund the schools, if you defund all aspects of the public sector, whether it's, you know, public housing, public schools, public libraries, all of these institutions that make up the public sector and the civic infrastructure of our society, with enormous levels of poverty and no hope of real investment in poor and working class black communities, then you use the police to hem that in. You use the police to keep that quarantine to certain areas of the city. And in a place like Chicago, not only do the police function to keep young black people locked into their neighborhoods, but literally when black teenagers take the train to downtown Chicago. The police wait there and push them back so that black teenagers are not allowed. They call them criminals and that they presume that they're there to rob people. And so they push them back into the train and they speak openly about this in the newspapers. And so you see what function the police are playing. So in the schools that are underfunded, they put the police in the schools. While they fire teachers and fire or don't have nurses or counselors, they put the police in the schools. So the police play a function in the schools where public resources are no longer being expended. And so Black Lives Matter has forced us to think more deeply about what the function of the police are, even when they say that they are here to serve and protect. And so I live in Philadelphia now, but I lived for several years in Chicago. And there it's very clear and palpable to see where, you know, in 2012, the city closed 52 public schools. It was the largest school closure in American history in a single signature of a pen. And of course, there was a budget deficit. There was a $50 billion budget deficit, they tell us. Well, it came out that from 2010, and then it was 2012, but now from 2010 to 2016, the city of Chicago has paid out $600 million in settlements for police brutality cases. And for them, that's just the cost of doing business. If we have decided we will not fund the public infrastructure, that we won't have a public sector that is robust and that can actually attend to the public, then we're going to pay for the police to play that role. And so you close down 52 public schools because you say you have a $50 million deficit, but then you pay off police brutality cases at the tune of $600 million is a very clear indication of what the priorities of the city government are. And you can look in cities across the country. You should look here. What percentage of the budget goes to the cops? It's like a third in LA. It's 40%. In Chicago, it's like 36%. In Philadelphia, it's 30%. This is where the public sector dollars are going, and not to actually creating a more involved, engaged civic society. In Baltimore, what was also exposed is the failure of the strategy that began in the Black movement 40 years earlier. The idea that if we just had more African Americans in political office, that would solve these issues that existed for African Americans in the city. And in some sense, of course, that made sense. In the 1960s, from 1964 to 1968, more than 500,000 African-Americans participated in urban uprisings of one form or another. There were 225 cities where Black people went into open rebellion. The top three reasons that a federal commission found when they went to every city that had a riot and interviewed people were poverty meaning unemployment or underemployment was one. Two was substandard housing. People's kids were getting attacked by rats. Three, police brutality. And so the inability to deal with those issues from the existing political infrastructure, which in all these cities was mostly white, it stood to reason that if Black people got people that looked like them into office, that those conditions would go away, that Black elected officials would actually invest in the city and treat the place where Black people called home differently. And so Black people got the keys to the city as white people are leaving and leaving with the tax dollars with them. And so there's a lot to say, and I'd say quite a bit about it in chapter 3 of my book, Black Faces in High Places. But the main thing is for this is that Baltimore, April 2015, for me, brings the question of that strategy to an end. In some ways, that's symbolic because the people still use the framework of, you know, we need more representatives that look like us in higher office. But if you think about Baltimore, a city with a Black woman as the mayor, the police chief was Black, half of the police force was Black, 40 miles from the White House where the first Black president resided, who had appointed the first Black attorney general, the highest officer in the United States. And none of this could stop Freddie Gray from getting his neck broken by the Baltimore police. In my book, I allude to the strange coincidence that Freddie Gray was picked up by the police and taken for a rough ride, meaning they put him in the back of a police van, with no seatbelt on, driving really fast, making really sharp turns and hard brakes, and they broke his neck, right? And they picked him up on April 12th, 2015, the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War, to the day, miles away from where the Armistice Agreement was signed in Appomattox, Virginia. And it says something about the formal equality, the formal end of slavery, and its hollowness in the everyday lives of Black people. In other words, that formal equality, written on a piece of paper in a script, that you are now free, meant nothing in the life of Freddie Gray. And it meant nothing in Freddie Gray's life long before he was picked up by the Baltimore police. And so if all of those Black people in power could not stop Freddie Gray from getting his neck broken, then that strategy as what will end this oppression and exploitation of African Americans in the communities that they live in must be reevaluated. And that is something else that comes out in this movement. The last thing is about the power of social movements. And I think that that is incredibly important right now. So Black Lives Matter, I think, in this very immediate context, shows us what a social movement can do in terms of exposing the contradictions of a society that otherwise people don't necessarily recognize, on the one hand. And on the other hand, it raises larger questions about the nature of our society, the questions that otherwise typically those questions don't get posed. But I think in this moment where everyone is looking to the 2020 presidential election, it also says that we should be cautious about, in the era of Trump and Trump's fanaticism and he's a white supremacist and all of that, which is very true and it's very visceral. When someone said last night at one of his Klan rallies that people should shoot immigrants, he laughed, the crowd laughed. That's who's occupying the White House. So that can't be diminished. But Black Lives Matter as a movement should remind us that the temptation to get back to normal is very dangerous. Because what is normal? Normal, if we're thinking about the previous administration, is what gave us Black Lives Matter in the first place. Normal was Trayvon Martin being murdered and people having to spend 45 days trying to get the person who murdered him to be arrested. Not to suffer any consequence, but to just be arrested. Normal was Oscar Grant being murdered on a subway platform, face down, following orders from the police, face down and shot in the back with about 200 people looking. That was normal, right? That was what preceded the Trump administration, and on and on and on. So the temptation to get back to normal is a very dangerous one, and we have to remember what this movement helped to excavate in order to understand that. And so part of that means understanding the power of a social movement as the vehicle historically that has been central to creating what we understand to be progress in the United States. That progress doesn't come from altruistic elected officials who feel bad for how the vast majority of us are living in this country. Progress comes from the initiative, the creativity, the militancy of ordinary people. And that, just as a quick pivot, is what was compelling to me about the Combahee River Collective, which was a small organization of Black feminists in the 1970s. 2017 was the 40th anniversary of a very powerful statement that they put out about Black feminism in 1977. And the two things that are important about that, that I'll end on in terms of what is important about their politics. One is the concept of solidarity. And so even though the Combahee Collective framed their analysis around the personal experiences of Black women, and this is what they meant by the personal is political. It wasn't a retreat into the interior of their lives. It was looking at the ways that Black women were demonized in everyday life, whether it was at the welfare office, whether it was through harassment by the police, and how this was a source of radicalization for them. This is what compelled them to question the nature of the society that we live in. But they were not blindly beholden to their personal experience alone. And so they called for solidarity, what they referred to as coalition building, which is to say that they understood that in order for a mass movement to be built that could challenge the society that was the source of their oppression and exploitation, that they had to look beyond their own experience, that they had to connect with women from the third world who were being bombed by the U.S. military in Vietnam, for example, that they had to connect with Chicanas who were involved in struggles for immigrant rights in their communities, that they had to look beyond their own situation to unite with people who had no interest in maintaining this oppressive society. So that was one, solidarity, and the idea that you don't have to experience a particular oppression to fight against it. The idea that an injury to one is an injury to all could be the basis upon political connection. And then that they were anti-capitalist, and that they understood that women's liberation, black liberation, could not actually exist within the confines of capitalism, that they had to organize society on a different basis, a basis that is completely antithetical to the way society is organized under capitalism, where you have a parasitic minority, the 1%, who live at the expense of the vast majority, the 99%, which is to say that there are 500 billionaires in the United States, because there are 45 million people living in poverty. One cannot exist without the other. People are poor because people are rich. And that is the dynamic, that is the ethos of capitalism. And they understood that, and understood that the end of oppression could only come with creating a different kind of society. What's the next step? What's the next step? Okay, we all got to get Bernie into the White House. Huh? Yeah. No, I want that too. No, I mean there's a lot of different things in the mix. I think the Sanders campaign is one expression of, you know, that the status quo is not good enough. I think even for 2016 that 13 million people vote for an open socialist is something that if you're of a certain generation is very difficult to get your mind around. But it says something about the lack of meaningful political alternative that exists, at least in the range of formal politics. And so I think that the Sanders campaign represents something significant. I think the growth of the Democratic Socialist of America, which has something like, you know, between 55,000 and 60,000 members, also represents something important in terms of the political shifts that are happening in this country. And then I think in terms of workplace activism, the most important political protests that have happened, I think, in the last year have been the teacher strikes that have literally taken the country by storm from West Virginia to Kentucky, Virginia, in Ohio, in Colorado, in California. The LA teachers had a huge victory. Charter school teachers in Chicago, who had never struck anywhere in the United States, have now won their third strike in the last couple of months. And so I think yesterday was the Uber and Lyft drivers' workplace action. And so I think that is indicative of, even, you know, when you have Trump on television every 5 minutes talking about how wonderful the economy is. Yes, if you just look at the numbers, but the numbers don't tell you about the quality of people's lives. It doesn't tell you about what it's like to carry around the tens of thousands of dollars of debt that we all walk around with. I teach at an Ivy League school, and I have $75,000 in student loan debt that I carry around. And so everybody, most people, are walking around with that kind of debt and no real job that can pay it off. So you get two or three of them, and then you try to figure out the health care, and then you hope you don't get a boot on your car, and then you hope you don't get one of these tickets. I mean, the whole thing is set up for you to fail. And I think people are coming to some realization about that when you look at the political leadership that is supposed to lead us out of this. And you have a Senate where the average wealth of a U.S. senator is $3 million. The average wealth of a person in the House of Representatives is $990,000. The average income of white families in the United States is somewhere between $60,000 and $70,000, and the average income for black families is somewhere between $40,000 and $47,000. This is a huge disconnect. We have millionaires and a billionaire president who are literally making decisions about what should happen in our lives. They want to change the definition of poverty so they can kick everybody off the rolls for the meager things that they call welfare in this country. And so this is what is meant when you say the center can't hold. So when you come in with, you know, Beto O'Rourke wants to jump up on a table and wave his arms around and, you know, oh, we're better than this. And it's like, no, this is what we are. You know, like the platitudes and frankly the bullshit does not wash anymore. And so the lines are getting drawn in a very stark and sharp way, as they should, and people will have to pick a side. And that's where politics matters in terms of how you understand how this has come to be, because there would be two sets of explanation. There's the explanations that the socialists give, that it's capitalism that have created these conditions, and then there's the explanation that the fascists and the Nazis give, which is that it's the Muslims, the Mexicans, and the blacks that are the reason there's so much insecurity in this country. And so we can't be passive about what we say about these things. We have to confront them, but also put forth an alternative, a different idea of how society can actually be organized. I think worse than the trauma porn is that it just becomes normalized, and it's almost like we become impervious to what it's supposed to do, right? Which it's supposed to shock us. It's supposed to shock us into acting, and it doesn't do that anymore because we're absolutely inundated with images of young black people being beaten by the police or being killed by the police. And so I think this is part of the problem of, I think, relying on that as a strategy, relying on that aspect of social media as a strategy, but also the idea that we can sort of just use social media platforms to organize a movement to stop these sorts of things, because you can see that these are deeply entrenched practices and that simply exposing them, even when it may have been shocking, is not enough. It's not enough to actually get to the underlying root of why police abuse and violence and murder is so pervasive. I mean, the police kill like 1,000 people a year in this country. And somewhere like in Germany, the police have killed like 12 people in the last 4 years. I mean, so when you look at the United States compared to its peer countries, there is no comparison. And so I think people will continue to show these videos in some ways, not necessarily for the same reasons that compelled them in the first place, but part of the social media dynamic is that individuals take control of these stories on their own and not necessarily as part of any collective or as part of any movement that anyone feels any particular sense of responsibility to. We have to think about what is meant by a social movement, how we want to be organized as a social movement, what does it mean to be accountable to a movement? These are all questions that I think came up in Black Lives Matter, but were not resolved. I think there are a lot of questions about democracy, accountability, and what is the nature of movement building, and what is the most effective way of movement building. These are questions that I think have yet to be answered. Well, this is why people are open to socialism, that socialism is no longer a dirty word, because, and this isn't true, but it feels like we have reached the limits of what liberalism can offer. They usually pull something out of their bag of tricks. So now that they'll give us, you know, Obamacare with a public option, and that'll be their big concession. But there is a sense to which the typical solutions just feel hollow. One of the points of tension around Black Lives Matter was the question of strategy, because for a lot of people, the movement was deeply radicalizing to the point where people had come to the conclusion that we should just abolish the police. We should abolish prisons. And so this is the context within which you get discussion about prison abolition as part of the mainstream discussion. I mean, I don't know if people know Ruthie Wilson Gilmore, who's one of the more well-known prison abolitionists in the United States. The New York Times just did a full profile. I read it on my phone, so I don't know how many pages. It was very long. It was probably like 3,000 words, which is extremely long in a newspaper, with Ruthie just talking about abolishing prisons and police. I've never seen anything like that. And it's part of the mainstream discussion because it's so clear what the liberals have offered does not work. You know, we'll reform the prisons and make them more humane, and it doesn't work. I mean, it continues to operate, but the number of people who become cynical about that, who begin to question that, and who begin to look for alternatives is growing. It's not at the same pace that the people who cling to the old ideas are, but it is growing. And that's what it means to be in the midst of a political radicalization. Radicalization, what does it mean? To look beneath the surface. The Latin word for radical is root. It's to look at the root. What is beneath? And that's what more people are doing, because the surface impressionistic responses to all this are becoming insufficient, not just in terms of explaining things, but certainly in terms of what they offer as solutions. We have intense political polarization. So we have the growth of the left and the right that are happening simultaneously, and it's the center that is being crushed, thank God. I mean, really, like, Beto O'Rourke was like the straw that stirred everybody's drink a year ago, and it's easy to look like that when you're going up against the Joker, the clown, you know, Ted Cruz. But when you're in, like, a race where people are talking about serious ideas, you look like a fool. And so the center is being crushed, and there's polarization on the left and the right. I mean, the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists are growing, and they're more confident because they have a president who talks like them and thinks like them in the White House. So you get at, you know, Poetry and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., in Chocolate City, these 10 white fascists who go into a bookstore, into a meeting to shut it down. And you have situations like that happening in different places around the country. So the point isn't to be complacent about the growth of the right, which I think the left is. I think, you know, it's like, well, they're doing, you know, their thing over there or whatever, when really the way that you shut down the right is to confront them. And not like a fist fight in the middle of the street, but the week after Charlottesville, neo-Nazis tried to march on Boston, and 40,000 people showed up, and they literally left in tears. And that's what it means to humiliate, demoralize, and drive back under the rock the fascists. But in order to understand that, you have to know that there's intense political polarization where both things are growing at the same time. It's complicated because, on the one hand, for me, it's always basic math, right? Black people are 13% of the population. So that means, in my math, which was always the weakest point of, you know, my agenda, that black people alone can't actually achieve black liberation, right? And I write a lot about this in the last chapter of the book. And so it means we have to have a multiracial movement, but it matters on what terms. It can't be on the basis of how do we not offend white people? You know, like, yeah, we can build a coalition on that basis. But it has to be on the basis of white people also understanding the ways that racism undermines their own life chances, quality of life in the United States. And so, you know, there are a million different examples of that. One, this country spends $80 billion a year to maintain its criminal justice system, and they use racism to get away with that. Well, the $80 billion that goes towards that could be going towards 80 billion other things that benefit black people, white people, Latinx people in this country. You think about the way that poverty is racialized in this country to such an extent that black poverty is hypervisible and white poverty is invisible, so that we get this phenomenon of deaths by despair, where for working class white people, their life expectancy has gone into decline, which this does not happen in the developed world. Life expectancy does not reverse. And it has reversed in the United States for working class white people who are dying because of opioid addiction, alcoholism, and suicide. Those are the factors that are driving what the scientists call deaths by despair. Welfare, right? Welfare. In 1996, Bill Clinton, at the, you know, very celebrated signing ceremony in the Rose Garden, he was surrounded by black women, signed the bill that ended welfare as a social entitlement called the Personal Responsibility and Work Act. He surrounds himself with black women at this signing, even though at that time the majority of people on welfare were white women. And there wasn't a white woman in sight except Hillary Clinton. And so they use racism to justify getting rid of welfare, because that's a giveaway to black people, even though the majority of people who were in need of it were white women. So as I write my book, racism is black people's burden, but it's also white people's problem. And so it means that there is a vested interest in changing the situation. It doesn't mean that the white people don't obviously get advantages from society the way that it's constructed, but not enough to say that, you know, they should tie their fate to Jeff Bezos, you know, as opposed to being a part of a multiracial movement that can transform this country, which is obviously always easier to say. But I think part of that is just looking at the reality of the situation and what the fate of most people in this country is and where the direction that it's headed. So I wrote an article yesterday for Jacobin in defense of reparations, in support of reparations. So I was looking at my phone before I walked up here, like 2 minutes before, and I got my first hate mail about the article. Some fool in Florida wrote me to tell me that the Confederacy did pay reparations 150 years ago, and then it's a very long email.
It's like $30.
Yeah, yeah, I know. I think reparations is important, and I think that people get hung up on the method of disbursement and miss the political significance. And so I think that, you know, I'm open to some group of people coming together to figure out what the disbursement should be. I think that, you know, the personal check is not enough. I mean, it's, how do you even put into language what slavery was, which complicates how you calculate what is owed on an individual basis? But I do think that the social payment in terms of debt relief, in terms of an enormous infusion of resources, all of these sorts of things that can go towards repairing some of the harm, not just caused by slavery, but by the racism that it produced, is the least that this country can do. Reparations are not unprecedented. They happen all over the world, except here. And the except here is connected to, and this is what I wrote about yesterday, is really the failure of this country to grapple with in any way its history of slavery, right? And I thought about this because I was in New Orleans for a week. And New Orleans constituted the largest slave market for the internal slave trade in the entire United States after the international transatlantic slave trade was cut off in 1808. New Orleans became the site of the internal slave trade within the United States. And if you walk through the streets of New Orleans, you have no, in the French Quarter in particular, where slaves were held in pens, up to 150 people per pen, you'd have no knowledge that these are the sorts of things that happen in this city. And it's not just New Orleans. This country has no national monument, no museum, no acknowledgement that slavery was foundational to its existence. That slaves built the White House, that slaves built the Capitol, where this nation determines what its laws are. There's no memory. There's no trace of it. And without any trace of it, the racism that was produced by it has no context. There's no context or understanding. And then when you overlay what is not known with what is then promoted by the country itself, that this is the country of unfettered social mobility, that all you have to do is work hard, and you try to fit that with the conditions of disproportionate poverty in black communities, they don't make sense. And so they're made sense by saying that, well, black people are defective. They have an inferior culture. They have a culture of poverty. They have broken families. And that's how we explain that. And so the consequences of forgetting that this was a country built on slavery are quite dramatic and far-reaching. And so when people say that, well, we should just fight for universal programs that benefit everyone, of course, on some level, sure, that's fine. But the question then becomes, how will you amass the type of movement that is necessary to fight for those universal programs when you ignore racism as a reality in the United States? And so the assumption is that we'll all just come together and fight for these things because they're the right things to fight for. But it ignores that there's a history that, you know, black people and white people, is just one example, have had shared interests since the end of slavery. And that shared economic interests are not enough to constitute the type of social movement that is necessary to actually fight for and win and achieve an agenda that can benefit everyone. And so without understanding the centrality to racism in American life, it limits the ability to build the kinds of movements and coalitions necessary to fight for that universal platform. And so for me, the fight for reparations is also about putting racism at the center of our understanding as what is wrong with the United States in the first place. And on that note, I'm going to end. Thank you for coming out.